Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 274 for August 15th, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
We see this product growing. We see this product taking on life of its own. But we're never going to compete in the next 10 years with the Maker's Marks and the Woodford Reserves. But we're going to run alongside them because we're different.
That's Dr. Pierce Lyons, the CEO of Lexington-based Alltech. His company makes yeast and products used for animal feed, but yeast is also used in brewing and distilling, and Dr. Lyons does that too. In fact, Alltech's Kentucky Brewing and Distilling Company has just released a new whiskey. It's not a bourbon. It's the first single malt whiskey distilled in Kentucky in at least 90 years. More with Dr. Pierce Lyons later, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, the What I'm Tasting This Week department, and an update on the WhiskeyCast Water of Life Drive. First, though, let's look at the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie. The big news of the week, Sir Ernest Shackleton's whiskey not only survived for 112 years on Antarctica, but as one WhiskeyCast listener put it on the Facebook page, it endured. After almost a month of slow thawing, the crate recovered from Shackleton's hut at Cape Royds revealed its contents at the Canterbury Museum in Christchurch, New Zealand. Nigel Watson is the executive director of the Antarctic Heritage Trust and joined me by Skype from Christchurch.
Mark, after much anticipation, our team here in New Zealand has examined and through a slow process of thawing managed to extract a number of bottles from a crate labelled Shackleton's whiskey. So what we have found is 11 bottles still in their packing of McKinley's rare old Highland malt whiskey. We're delighted that of those 11 bottles, 10 of those look fully intact with their liquid contents, and in fact we can still see the label there on each of those bottles. So we're delighted to have got to this point in the process.
Now you said 10 are intact. What about the 11th one?
The 11th, the bottle is intact, but it doesn't have the same full liquid content. So in some point it's been compromised, and that would be consistent with the smell of whiskey that we've had through this crate as it slowly defrosted in a controlled manner over the last couple of weeks here in New Zealand.
So that would give us an indication that what's inside those other 10 bottles probably is still pretty good.
Absolutely, and that's our hope. From here, the next stage is that the bottles will each individually be carefully assessed and conserved in the coming weeks. And from that point, we then plan to work with the owners of the McKinley's brand, White and Mackay, to extract and analyse the whiskey. We still need to go through that process in terms of how we can most efficiently achieve that, but possibly through a syringe, through into a couple of the bottles to ensure we can get a sample, and some chemical analysis could then be undertaken on the contents. The ultimate aim White and Mackay have expressed is to replicate the original blend so that whiskey drinkers the world over can enjoy this piece of history. But of course there's much to do to see if that's possible.
Now you found one empty container, right? Some wrappings for what looked like to be a 12th bottle in that box.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's another little twist in the tail here. Is one of the straw wrappings is empty. There's one bottle is obviously missing from the packing inside the crate, and that's consistent with where the crate itself appears to have been jimmied open and the timber broken. So the speculation is that perhaps one of Shackleton's crew just couldn't resist a tipple.
Were you surprised that these bottles came out relatively intact?
Yeah, I think we're particularly surprised. We've had a whisky expert down here in New Zealand looking at the process, and he expressed surprise this morning about the great condition of these bottles. Obviously, they've been in a very extreme environment, and we're really surprised and heartened by the condition they appear to be in at this stage. We've learned a little more from the labels that this looks to be either a pure malt or a blended malt, and you know, we're hopeful that the analysis will bear out the exact specifications of the original whiskey, given the recipe has been lost.
Now, when I talked with Alf Astier a few months ago after this was first really revealed to the public, he told me he really wasn't sure he wanted to taste the whiskey inside and thought it would be better to be left as a mystery. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. We're not here with the ultimate aim of trying to be able to sample this whiskey as much as many hundreds of and thousands of keen whiskey drinkers would love that to happen. There is a sense here that we need to ensure that we can undertake the best analysis and learn some more about that that process of whiskey making from the late 1800s. It's also a treasured artifact in its own right. It belongs spiritually, no pun intended, back at Cape Evans. This is the site of Shackleton's only expedition base, and this is part of those expedition supplies. So, you know, we're not rushing now to drink it. Of course, that would be a great thing for some whiskey drinkers, but our focus is on conservation, not on consumption.
As you might expect, the news that the 10 surviving bottles will not be opened did not go over well with many of those thousands of whiskey lovers Nigel was referring to. In fact, one very highly retweeted comment on Twitter by a guy with the username Drew Toothpaste put it this way. They found a crate of Ernest Shackleton's scotch he left in Antarctica 100 years ago and nobody's allowed to taste it? Bleep, you scientists. And the bleep is mine. No word yet on when Richard Patterson from White & Mackay will head to New Zealand to try and extract a sample. And as for that one leaking bottle, a couple of listeners posted comments on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Michael Caldwell was hoping for a bucket under the leaking one, with maybe a funnel and capita too. Matt Wooler had a possible reason why one bottle sprung a leak. It was just the Angels taking their long-awaited share. I'll keep you updated as more details become available. We have some new whiskeys to talk about this week. It's not often that we get new Japanese whiskeys to talk about, but Suntory is releasing two. The Yamazaki Punchin will carry no age statement. It was matured in 488-liter Punchin casks made at the distillery from American white oak. Meanwhile, Suntory's Hakushu Distillery is releasing a heavily peated expression, also aged in American white oak casks. Both are bottled at 48% ABV and will only be available in limited quantities at retailers in the UK and Europe. Glengoyne is releasing two limited edition single cask bottlings. The 13 and 23-year-old expressions were selected by the distillery's staff. 548 bottles of the 23-year-old will be available worldwide, along with 256 bottles of the 13-year-old. Glenfarclas is releasing the fifth round of its Family Casks series. This edition includes casks from 1965, 1967, 1981, 1982, 1990, 1993, and 1994. The oldest expression in the Family Casks series dates back to 1952, and the distillery has run out of it. By the way, the Glenfarclas 105 Cask Strength Edition is getting new packaging. And on that note, Chivas Regal is getting a facelift. Designer Alexander Trockett was commissioned to create a new gift tin for the 12-year-old Chivas Regal. It'll be available globally, but just like all facelifts, it'll fade away eventually. It'll just be a limited number of tins available worldwide. Bal Blair has released its latest vintage in the UK. The 2000 vintage is bottled at 43% ABV. White & Mackay's whiskey is going to be getting better distribution in the U.S. Last year, Shaw Ross International took over U.S. distribution of the Dalmore, and now the two companies have agreed on rights for the rest of White & Mackay's brands, including the namesake White & Mackay blended whiskey. The U.S. will also be getting whiskeys from Berry Brothers and Rudd. The London Spirits retailer and bottler has set up a partnership with Anchor Brewers and Distillers in the U.S. to import the Berry's own selection whiskeys and other brands into the U.S. This does not affect the Glenrothes, which Berry Brothers acquired the rights to from Edrington Group earlier this year, and will continue to be distributed by Sky Spirits. Now, the worst whiskey I've ever tasted will never show up on my tasting notes, unless I have the misfortune of tasting it again. Lac Du Black Whiskey came from Manicmore Distillery and has been unavailable for a number of years. However, a private collector in the UK has several hundred bottles of this stuff stashed away and is selling individual bottles for around $300 apiece. A news release from the seller claims that some Las Vegas hotels have bought a number of bottles and are selling Lac Du for $100 a shot. I'm posting a link to the seller's website at the WhiskeyCast website, just in case you're interested. By the way, the reason it won't be on my tasting notes is that I wasn't scoring whiskeys the one time I tried it back in 2005. And while I have my notes from that dreadful experience, I don't do retroactive scoring. It tasted like rum and bourbon mixed together, medicinal with notes of prunes and raisins. Let's end the news segment on a happy note now. During the Fage Isle series, we met Ian MacArthur, the warehouseman at Lagavulin. Ian celebrated his 40th year in the business this month and was honored in a ceremony at the distillery. Congratulations, Ian. And that's the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie, handcrafted by the 16 men of Tain since 1843. Let's look at the emails of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. In fact, Ian MacArthur figures into the first letter of the week. Last time around, we heard the ringtone Tom Alius in Belgium created after the Fage Isle series, featuring Ian along with 3-year-old Chloe Kelby.
What's Daddy's favorite whiskey?
Our big Lagavulin, Laphroaig, Kalila, Bamor, Ricklardy, Bunhaven, Kilhoman.
I started in Portland Distillery, and I left Portland Distillery in 1983, when Portland Distillery shut, and I came up here to Lagavulin.
Heard from Chloe's parents this week. Peter and Karen say they're fine with posting the ringtone on the WhiskeyCast website, and they passed along a message from Chloe.
Hello, Marcus. Chloe Kelby from Dundee. Hello, how are you? I love my new ringtone. I hope everybody will download it. It was nice meeting you and Isla. Hope to see you again next year. Love you. Goodbye.
Thank you, Chloe. It's good to hear from you again. I have a feeling we're going to be hearing a lot from her in the future. You can download that ringtone at the WhiskeyCast website. Also, last time we heard about the debut of Hammerhead Whiskey from the Czech Republic. Got an email from Peter Hosek this week. Dear Mark, thanks for the last podcast and the info about the first Czech single malt. I'm a Czech living in Austria. I know the Stock Distillery thanks to their Fernet. And yes, I once tried their blended whiskey called Printers, but wasn't at all impressed. The message about the single malt was like a hammer for me, pun intended. Oddly enough, I was traveling to Prague the day after I listened to your podcast and spotted the whiskey in the travel free shop at the country border. Without your podcast, I would have probably never spotted it. And now the best part, I tasted it and the liquid is pretty good. Czech oak. Who would have thought? Thanks for the great podcasts. Peter Hosek, Vienna, Austria. I checked with Tony Roberts at Stock Spirits Group, and the whiskey just arrived at the border very close to the time Peter did. In fact, Tony thinks he may well have bought one of the first bottles of Hammerhead to be sold. Now, if you have a question or a suggestion, my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The emails of the week are brought to you by Highland Park. Just click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website to join Highland Park's inner circle. Now, the last episode also kicked off the WhiskeyCast Water of Life drive to help Charity Water supply a village in a developing nation with fresh drinking water. As I'm recording this, we've raised $2,096 in just the first week and a half. I want to thank Pat McCarthy of Bayway Liquors in Elizabeth, New Jersey. He and an anonymous donor both gave $100 each to the campaign. Joshua Hatton gave $36 with an explanation for the unusual amount. He wrote, "In Hebrew, each letter in the alphabet has a numerical equivalent. The word chi, or life, has a numerical equivalent of 18. 18 times 2 equals 36, or chaim lives. To life, l'chaim." Great idea. Thank you, Joshua. The auction for the case of Amrut single malt whiskey is also doing well. The high bid currently stands at $700, thanks to Simon Seaton in Aberdeen, Scotland, for his bid. Bidding on that will continue through August 31st. It's a six-bottle case of the new and still-secret Amrut expression to be released in October. All six bottles will be signed by Amrut's owner. You can bid by sending an email with your name, address, age, and phone number to this email address, water@whiskeycast.com. Again, the Water of Life Drive was inspired by the McAllen's Sierra Perdue Decanter World Tour, an auction for charity water. And the group's CEO, Scott Harrison, joins me on the phone now from New York City. First of all, Scott, tell us about charity water, how it came to be, and what kind of work you're doing in these developing countries.
Sure. Well, I started when I was 30 years old, so almost 4 years ago. In fact, we're turning four next month. And really simple mission, bring clean and safe drinking water to the world's billion people that currently live without that.
And a billion is a large number, but it's a reachable number. We actually have the technology to do this, right?
Well, I think that was the thing that really brought me to water. You know, I'd served as a volunteer photojournalist for a couple of years alongside these incredible humanitarian surgeons in Liberia, West Africa, and I'd seen, you know, so many ill people, so many people without access to healthcare. But when we learned that 80% of disease on the planet is directly related to dirty water and a lack of sanitation, just lack of toilets, we thought, wow, we can get to the root cause and make an incredible impact. And as you said, there are solutions. You know, we know how to bring clean water to a billion people. Sometimes it's a hand-dug well. Sometimes it's a deep well. Sometimes it's a rainwater harvesting system or a biosand filter. But there are ways to help, and it actually doesn't even cost that much money.
Now, you say for $5,000, you can help a village of 250 people for 20 years. Explain how this works.
Yeah, well, the average cost of a well is about $5,000, and, you know, the projects actually get as expensive as $100,000, but obviously serves larger communities. But a typical well is just a hand-dug well, and the community will actually contribute the labor. So most of the cost is just in cement and PVC and the hand pump that goes on. You know, some of the local skilled laborers, the masons and the engineers. And it takes about 6 weeks from beginning to end for the community to dig the well. And we'll then, you know, the hand pump is put on. So, you know, $5,000 divided by 250 people, which is a pretty average size of a community, you know, it's $20 a person. It's so affordable.
And you're working in 16 or 17 different countries, right?
17 countries, so 11 in Africa. And then, you know, doing work in Southeast Asia and also in a big commitment to Haiti, also Honduras.
And it should be explained that you don't actually have charity water staff going out digging the wells and working with these folks. You work with NGOs or non-governmental organizations that are already in these countries and already have existing contacts, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, when I started, I realized that, you know, I'd travel around quite a bit, and I saw these incredible local national NGOs doing fantastic work on the ground. And what they were really pretty lousy at was fundraising and marketing, telling their story. And, you know, I thought, you know, charity water is really, we're never going to be expert hydrologists. You know, we don't want to go and set up NGOs in 17 countries around the world. Let's come alongside these national staff, come alongside the locals, and increase their capacity. So, you know, a great example would be finding a water program that had the capacity to drill or dig 300 water projects a year. But they might only have the money for 50. And that's where we come in. You know, we take them to the full 300 and then work alongside to figure out, you know, how do we even double the size of the program? How do we get them to do 600 projects a year and then 900 and 1200? So, you know, there are more than 1,000 people around the world working on charity water projects, but you won't see our staff actually digging or drilling. All of our field visits are really working with our partners, monitoring, evaluating, auditing, et cetera.
And 100% of the donations go straight to water projects, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that was that's another kind of unique thing about our model. When I started, you know, I saw this huge group of people, mainly around my age, because that's who I was talking to at the time, and they were disenchanted with charity. And they said, yeah, the main reason we're not giving is because we don't know how much of our money is actually going to reach the people in need. And there is a cost to running a charity, and there are acceptable costs. And we just decided, hey, let's try and bring some people back to the table, get them interested in giving again, and split those costs. So we'll find one group of people, private donors, corporate sponsors, board members, to cover all of the staff, all of the operating costs, all of the educational campaigns, so that 100% of every dollar from the public would go directly to on-the-ground project costs. And we even pay back credit card fees, which is crazy. So if a donor were to give $10,000 on his Amex, you know, Amex only gives us $9,600, but we raise the $400 and send all $10,000 to the project.
Wow. Tell me a story about one of these projects that you've seen put into place. Tell me about going to one of these villages.
Sure. Gosh, you know, there's a great story that came out of Uganda recently, a woman named Helen Apio. And, you know, often in these communities, women will have to walk hours each day. And then they're walking to a polluted source, a stream or a river or a pond. And Helen just told us a story that we hadn't really thought of before. I mean, we talk about disease, and we know that bad water is, you know, it kills kids, and 4,500 kids die every single day. We know all the statistics. We know about water and its impact on education and half of the world's schools don't even have clean water. But Helen was telling us that her biggest challenge was because she was walking so far, she just never had enough water. It wasn't even clean water. And she would have to make choices every day between washing her face, washing her body, washing her kids, washing the school uniforms, drinking, cooking, and gardening. I think there were 6 different things, and she never had enough. So each day it would be this, you know, what should I use the limited amount of water, sometimes only 5 gallons, to do all these things? You know, that's a toilet flush of water. I mean, you can imagine. And after the well was put in her village, you know, she told us that the main sort of, you know, we're like, well, how is your life different now? And she said, I feel beautiful now because I have enough water to wash. And we learned that basically her sacrifice, she never washed her face. I mean, she never really used the water on herself. It was always, you know, looking out for the kids. It was always keeping the kids clean or keeping their uniforms or making sure there was food. And she said, I am beautiful now because I'm clean. And, you know, that kind of broke our hearts.
That's a truly inspiring story, Scott. Tell me one last question, how the McAllen folks got involved with you.
Oh, man, I what I've loved about this campaign is just the creativity that they've really displayed. You know, they make incredible whiskey, and some of it is very expensive whiskey. And, you know, said, what if we could take this this thing and turn it into clean water for people? And, you know, they put the idea of a world tour, taking this bottle around the world to spread awareness of the issue. And to taste it, you know, one community would need to get clean water. And, you know, the starting price for a dram was $5,000. And it's been remarkable what they've accomplished. In 5 cities already in this tour, they've raised $42,000. That's incredible. More than 8 communities will get access to clean water. And then they'll take the bottle to Sotheby's in November, in mid-November, and hope to get considerably more, you know, enough perhaps to fund 20 additional communities. So I just love the creativity that the company can say, you know, hey, maybe we can't write a huge check at the moment, but we can do something better. We can raise awareness and get a lot of people involved.
Now, anybody can do this. I mean, it took me basically about 5 minutes to set up a page on your site to start raising
money. I'm glad it was so easy.
Yeah, it was extremely easy. But anybody can do this, right?
But here's the big idea, I think, for your listeners. When I was 32, got the idea that maybe there was something really behind birthdays. And I gave up my 32nd birthday. And I just started asking everyone I knew for my age in dollars to donate $32. And I wound up raising like $90,000. The idea just spread and spread and spread. And, you know, of course, I'd started the thing, so I had a little bit of a leg up. But over the last couple of years, literally millions and millions of dollars has been raised for Charity Water through this simple idea that we have everything we really want or need. You know, I don't need another tie. My wife doesn't need a handbag. And yet we've got a sixth of the planet, a billion people, that don't even have access to clean water. What if our birthdays could help them have more birthdays? And, you know, 7-year-olds go out and ask for $7, and 81-year-olds have gone out and asked for $81. And, you know, it's a really simple process to sign up online. There's a website called mycharitywater.org. And the cool thing is, because of the 100% model, we can track every single dollar to a project. So when your community raises $5,000, you'll actually be able to see a picture, not only a picture, but a GPS of that well. You'll be able to look at it on Google Earth and see the tangible results of what your gift did. So, you know, everyone listening has a birthday, and it's a really fun idea. You know, sometimes people give up the gifts around the holidays and say, you know, as a family, we're not going to spend, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 on gifts. You know, we're going to try and even raise a little more and give the gift of clean water to a community. We've had people give up weddings, anniversaries. We just had someone yesterday skydive, jump out of a plane, and she was terrified, and she got sponsored to raise money for clean water. So mycharitywater.org is just a place where people can, you know, sure, birthdays, but just be creative and bring who they are to the issue.
And if you visit mycharitywater.org/whiskeycast, that's where you can donate in the Water of Life drive that we're doing. How long will it take once we
go ahead? Yeah, you guys are up to $2,000 already, which is amazing.
Already, and I am convinced that we're going to make this goal. I'd like to do it by the end of August if we can. But officially, I'm setting the goal for September, by the end of September, to do this, because I know September 30th, you're planning on putting more money out into the field, right?
Yep, absolutely.
How long will it take the money that the WhiskeyCast listeners are donating to actually get to the field?
So it'll actually go out probably the second week of August, maybe the third week, of October, so 2 or 3 weeks later. And then the next process takes about 12 to 18 months, normally about 12 months. And that's where all these the projects are surveyed, and then the teams go out and they start working with the local communities. Wells start getting dug, pumps start getting put in, and then we send out other teams to do the monitoring and evaluation and the proving it. And then we get that data back 12 to 18 months, and we tie every dollar to well, so your community will be able to actually see the impact of that gift.
Okay, Scott, thank you again for all the hard work you're doing because you're making an impact on people around the world. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to help you as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, we're at $2,096 so far. All I'm asking you for is just $10. Sure isn't my age, but it's about what you'd pay for a dram of one of the McAllen's expressions at your local bar. You can visit mycharitywater.org/whiskeycast to donate, and thank you for your support. Now let's look at the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. The Saratoga Invitational Beer, Bourbon, and Scotch Tasting is this coming weekend in Saratoga Springs, New York. The Brandy Library in New York City will host an Oban Tasting August 25th. The next night is the Whiskey Guild's Whiskey on the Hudson Tasting Cruise in New York. Auchentoshan Distillery's annual open day is August 28th, just outside Glasgow. Whiskey Live Taipei and Whiskey Live Sydney are the same weekend, August 27th and 28th. Kensington Wine Market in Calgary, Alberta will host an Aaron Whiskey Tasting September 2nd, and Whiskey Messen 2010 is September 4th in Copenhagen. By the way, listen for special Whiskey Cast coverage from Whiskey Live Paris the weekend of September 25th and 26th. Those are just a few of the events going on around the world over the next few weeks, and you'll find a complete calendar of events at the Whiskey Cast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click on the Laphroaig banner at the Whiskey Cast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. Kentucky is known as bourbon country, but Dr. Pierce Lyons likes to do things differently. He's the CEO of Alltech, which makes yeasts and animal feed supplements in the Lexington area. Alltech is also the title sponsor for the upcoming World Equestrian Games in Lexington next month. And several years ago, Pierce Lyons decided he wanted to do something else special for the games. You may remember episode 180 back in January of 2009 when we heard from Christopher Bird, the brewer at Alltech's Kentucky Brewing Company. He laid down the casks of what is now Pierce Lyons Reserve, the first single malt whiskey distilled in Kentucky in more than 90 years. I caught up with Dr. Lyons this week on his mobile phone, and you might hear a bit of static from time to time.
The first thing I think we should probably do is explain how you got into the brewing and distilling business, because I know Alltech primarily makes yeasts and cultures for animal feed, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. But in fact, the whiskey side and the distilling side precedes the animal side by literally decades. You know, on my mom's side, for five generations, they have been whiskey barrel producers. And the reality is that our company has been based on brewing and distilling. I came to this country in the late 70s because everybody was talking about fuel alcohol and taking things like corn and converting them into ethanol. And since my background, my PhD, is in yeast, and yeast particularly as applied to brewing and distilling, I was sort of a natural fit, as it were. I'm also a natural fit for brewing and distilling because on my mom's side, they've been barrel makers, whiskey barrel makers, for five generations. So you could say that I've grown up with the, you know, the smell of a whiskey barrel and beer and so forth in my lungs, in my breath, and you know, it's just been my background.
And that was in Ireland, right?
And that was in Ireland, yes. And like I said, in fact, I was the first Irishman, believe it or not, to go to a formal brewing school and spent 3 years studying the art and science of brewing. And ironically, my son Mark, who hopefully will take the business on to the next generation, he has identical qualifications. He's done his master's and PhD in the same area.
Now, the formal part of the brewing business, you started up about 1999 in Lexington with the Lexington Brewing Company, right?
Yeah, a funny little story there too, Mark. My son's name is Mark. So when Mark finished his undergraduate degree up in Chicago, he said, well, now, Dad, what do I do? And I said, well, wait a second. You should have thought of that before you started your degree. And he said, well, Dad, why don't I do what you did? And so we decided that it was time for him, in fact, he would study brewing. But we had no place that he could go and get experience in brewing. But guess what? There was a small little brewery downtown Lexington, the Lexington Brewing Company. I called up the owner. I had put a little investment in there at one stage. And I said, can Mark come down and get some experience? He said, he can, but better hurry up because we're closing. Well, we went down. That was a Sunday night, Mark, and we bought the brewery that Sunday night. And our beer was born. And I decided when we would brew the beer, that rather than brewing a summer ale and a winter ale, I was going to brew three beers ultimately. One beer would be what emerged as Kentucky Ale. The second beer, because most people want a light, would be a truly flavorsome light. And so we produced Kentucky Light. And then finally, true to my heritage, I said, now why don't we take the marriage of Kentucky, where we have to use our barrels but once. So why don't we take those barrels, carefully select them, from the Woodford Reserves and the Maker's Mark, and take my beer, Kentucky Ale, put it into the barrel, and we created Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Ale.
Which I've had, and it's a very, very good beer. How did you progress from that into setting up the distillery a few years later?
Well, again, so now I had, we got something started, and I'm now almost following my career path, being a brewer first and then becoming a distillery. I used to travel the length and breadth of Scotland. I've been in virtually every whiskey distillery up there. And I thought, you know, when I did my research, much to my amazement, there hasn't been a whiskey in Lexington, Kentucky since the 60s, and there hasn't been a malt whiskey in America since Prohibition. And I know how to make a malt whiskey. I know how to make a bourbon. So why would we not, in fact, take that step? And you may think that's a big step. In actual fact, it's not. Because the process used to make beer is very similar to the process used to make malt whiskey. Now, not bourbon, but malt whiskey. You start with all malt. You make the brew. You carry out the fermentation. And you go ahead and you have your two pot stills, copper pot stills, and you can make a malt whiskey. In order that we wouldn't do it wrong, that we wouldn't make a mistake, we went to Scotland. We bought two pot stills, two copper pot stills, from the finest pot still producer in the world, the Forsyth, and we brought them directly over to Lexington, Kentucky. And here was another twist. Maybe we were around the Scots too long. We decided, well, why build a distillery when in actual fact we could have a distillery and a brewery on the one site? And we have to get special permission to do precisely that, and that's just precisely what we have. We have our brewery, and Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, we're typically brewing our beer. And then Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, we're making whiskey. So we have the two side by side. Now, that's going to change because we have committed ourselves to putting in Lexington, Kentucky's first whiskey distillery in I don't know how many years. And that's construction of that plant will start immediately after the Alltech World Equestrian Games.
Tell me more about that. What are you planning to do with this? Because your engineers did a pretty good job of integrating the pot stills into the current small brewery. Yes. And what do you plan to tell me more about this expansion?
Well, again, the whiskey itself, and we had this big committee to come up with a name. And finally, the committee of one, came up with the name, and the best name I could think of was my own name, Pierce Lyons. And so we have Pierce Lyons Reserve, and that was launched on August the 3rd, which is my birthday. And we launched it initially to the trade, and now we've started bringing it around, literally around the world, because we're in 120 offices. And so our whiskey will very quickly go to those 120 offices. And there's not too many boutique distillers who can do that almost in the first 3 months, but we can. But what are we going to do? What's the next step? You know, we need somewhere which is truly American. We need somewhere which is a destination. We need somewhere that we can say, wow, this is amazing. And we do have distillers like that, the Woodford, the Maker's Mark. There are lots of little distilleries, but we've done in Lexington. And so the idea is now to produce it, well, it's already being produced, but give it its own home, as it were. So its home won't just be in the brewery, it'll be in its own little distillery side by side.
So are you going to have to move the brewery? Because for people who have not been to Lexington, your brewery and distillery is on the west side of town. I'm trying to figure out a way to describe this for somebody who hasn't seen it, but it's in a... Right, borders a residential area, but there's, I think it's pretty well landlocked by roads. Are you going to have to build a new facility for both now, or what?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. You're being very kind to that area. That area was run down, and not a lot of investment went in there. And so what we have done, in fact, with the help of the residents, we've actually got ourselves a piece of land right there. Yes, we are landlocked. But you know what? We're landlocked in a nice way, because the highways, Newtown Pike, which will be the entrance into Lexington, Kentucky, stops right at the new brewery. So there isn't a big deal. The brewery will be able to expand because we take the pot stills out. The distillery will be able to be built and continue to expand because it'll have its own designated area. But we're talking about something which is, you know, 10 yards, 15 yards, one from the other. So
okay.
They're still very much integrated together.
Okay, because I know that main highway comes right by on one side, and then you've got roads around all around the distillery, and that's what I was trying to
roads
figure out how you're going to...
But you know, the local residents, they love it. There was an old house there, it was called the Ice House, because just after Prohibition, you know, brewers and distillers had to survive somewhere, so they made ice. Well, we've taken that ice house, and we've made that into a welcome center. And as you go in there, you will... we've got a little street, and that street will have the famous names of Irish pubs and images and so forth. And anybody who hasn't been there, if you really like whiskey, if you really like beer, come see the marriage of beer and whiskey. Come see a beautiful facility right downtown Lexington. And come, incidentally, at the time of the World Equestrian Games, what a way to see horses and almost what it really is, which is a World Expo, and at the same time, come down to our brewery, come down to our distillery.
And this is sort of the Olympics for the horse set, correct?
It's the Olympics for a horse. It's more than that. This event has never been outside of Europe, never. And I don't think the Europeans wanted it to come here. But now it's come here. We have like 1,400 acres. The Germans had 30, 40 acres. But it's way more than horses. We have groups such as the Temptations, the Beach Boys, coming in to play at the event. We have, for the kids, petting sharks, believe it or not, and penguins. So it's not just horses. It's a day out for everybody. But more important, it's Kentucky's opportunity to shine in front of a world stage. It's the biggest sporting event come into this country this year, and that's quite something.
Obviously so. The question I have for you, with all the bourbon that's produced in Kentucky, it would have been easy for you to produce another bourbon, but why the malt whiskey? Was that going back to your Irish heritage?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, we are a bourbon country, and incidentally, we have made a bourbon also, and we decided not to roll that out until later. But the thing that we know best and thing that we can do differently is a malt whiskey, but not a heavy, heavy malt whiskey like some of them are in Scotland, but a malt whiskey which will be true to our heritage, but a malt whiskey which is designed for the American palate. And that's what Pierce Lyons Reserve is all about. Yes, we could have made a bourbon, and we would have competed with the Maker's Marks and the Woodford Reserves and the Old Foresters and all the great bourbons. But why do that when there's a void there? There hadn't been a malt whiskey for 90 years. So I know how to make it. I have the pot stills. These pot stills have been designed to make malt whiskey. Let's go for a market where we think there's a void. And let's go for a market where, you know, we don't have to wait for the Scots anymore just to make the malt whiskey. We got our own.
Now, I didn't realize that there had actually been malt whiskey produced in Kentucky as far back as 1919. I thought this was the first malt whiskey that had ever been produced in Kentucky.
I thought so, too. But in actual fact, when we did our research, we did find that there were malt whiskeys in Kentucky like 90 years ago. I'm not sure if they were large volumes or small volumes, but there was a malt whiskey. And so I'd love to say we were the first ever malt whiskey, but we're not. I happen to think that we're one of the best. I sent the malt whiskey, incidentally, off to Scotland and had the people at the, some personal friends of mine who work for the Shivers of this world, and over there they didn't know what they were tasting, as it were. We just put it a blind test. And they came back with raving. They said, this is fantastic, this is wonderful. This is a lowland, almost lowland highland malt whiskey. No traces of peatiness, no traces of the iodine characteristic that you get in some of these malts. Just a fantastic malt whiskey. And why shouldn't it be when I've been sort of planning this and thinking about this for maybe 30, 40 years?
Now, you said you're sending bottles of this to your offices at Alltech around the world in 120 countries, but it's initially going to be sold only in Kentucky officially, right?
Absolutely. That product is rolled out in Kentucky, and the first batches are primarily for Kentucky and they're for the Alltech World Equestrian Games. But, we have to do something in this country with regard to exports, and since we're already exporting to 120 countries, and they're all little Alltechs, Alltech Bolivia, Alltech China, Alltech France. They love this idea. They love this association with Kentucky. And so we have an opportunity to have literally within weeks a launch at each and every one of our offices. It's a dream come true, my friend.
It sounds wonderful. How are you able to ramp up production or to be able to keep this going over time, or is this going to be... This is going to be permanent, as you said before, but how are you going to be able to satisfy the market over the years as it grows?
Well, as the market grows, you know, we obviously we're going to have to put in further investment, and I'm not naive enough to say that, you know, you can't ramp up whiskey production. This stuff is has been three to four years in its making, and so, you know, obviously you have to try and plan well, and we are planning and planning well. Price nothing is still nothing. We see this product growing, and we see this product taking on a life of its own, but we're never going to compete in the next 10 years with the Maker's Marks and the Woodford Reserves. But we're going to run alongside them because we're different. And so I don't, we anticipated that demand would be great, and I think we've made something like 50,000 gallons. So we've got way enough for the next 18 months. And meanwhile, every day, or not every day, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, we're laying down new whiskey. And so that's for the future.
When do you think you're going to release that bourbon you mentioned?
Well, that's a good point. So when will we release the bourbon? I believe, Mark, we'll release that bourbon after the games. You know, we want to get this successful launch of this product, like we've had the successful launch of the Kentucky, of the bourbon coffee, which we call Bluegrass Sundown. That's something you have when the sun goes down. We've got enough on our hands with these two. We've got upwards of 600,000 to 900,000 people coming in. If every single person in two Kentucky to see the games, think about it. If every single person decided, hey, I want a bottle, we wouldn't have anything like enough bottles. This is going to become a collector's piece, and the games have an opportunity to launch something at this moment in time. There'll never be a better time. The world is looking at us. People want to take a bottle, a little piece of Kentucky home. What better than taking a little piece of Kentucky whiskey, a whiskey that hasn't been made in the Commonwealth for 90 years. Doesn't get any better than that.
If you want to find a bottle of Pierce Lions Reserve, you'll have to go to Kentucky yourself. State law bans retailers from shipping spirits out of the Commonwealth. I've been promised a sample, though, and I'll pass along my tasting notes on a later episode. In the meantime, though, I've been cleaning up my office at home and going through some of the other samples that have come in recently, along with a few that accidentally found their way to the back of the tasting table for a while. One of those was Lady Luck from Compass Box. John Glazer took two casks of Kalila, one 25 and the other 29 years old, and batted them with a cask of 14-year-old Imperial to create this blended malt at 46% ABV. The nose is smoky with subtle fruity undertones, especially figs and pears. The taste is a complex mix of smokiness and pepper with a slight brininess. I also found some grassiness and heather as the spices fade. I'm attributing that to the influence of the Imperial, and it carries straight into the finish. Lady Luck is very consistent and smooth, and I'm scoring it a 94. Now, I mentioned Berry Brothers and Rudd's new U.S. distribution deal earlier. The Berry's Own selection line is its single cask bottlings, and since I just mentioned Imperial, let's talk about the 1989 single cask of Imperial from the Berry's Own selection line. It's bottled at 46% ABV. The nose is dry and crisp with notes of malt, green apples, and lemon zest. The taste is citrusy with a lemon tartness, malty, and slightly floral underneath. The finish is long and tart. Very consistent, and I'm scoring the Berry's Own Selection 1989 Imperial Single Cask an 85. I opened up some Mortlach 1990 from Cooper's Choice as well this week. It was bottled in 2008 after aging for 18 years in a sherry butt. The nose is soft cinnamon and oak with figs, almonds, and a bit of Christmas cake. The taste is spicy and thick with cinnamon, brown sugar, and a touch of toffee, and the finish is spicy and lingering with that same touch of toffee underneath. I'm scoring the Cooper's Choice 1990 Mortlach an 83. Finally, I've often said that your tastes may be completely different than mine, and here's an example for you. Douglas XO is a blended scotch from Douglas Lang & Company, bottled at 40%. I found the nose dry and very sherried with a hint of spearmint. That same spearmint note dominated the taste along with sherry notes and a hint of lavender underneath, and the finish was soft and minty. To be honest, it was a bit too minty for me, and I'm scoring the Douglas XO an 80, but I had my wife Christina try it out. She loved it and said it was one of the few whiskies that she would consider drinking on a regular basis. Like I said, tastes vary, and yours may well be completely different from mine. But you can compare your notes against mine with the WhiskeyCast iPhone app sponsored by the Glenrothes and at the WhiskeyCast website, too. That's also where you'll find more details on the Water of Life Drive, links to my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast website, the calendar of events, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.